Chapter 38. The Scalarium. Though Thalem would never admit it, Gusti had been right about Dagana. Thalen's affair with her intoxicated and maddened him. Their lovemaking was a joy. The bed became a haven of discovery and transport. But on mundane matters, they rubbed one another like whetstones without polishing off their sharp edges. They fought and dramatically broke up, then they reunited. At times, they created trivial reasons to be jealous of one another. Often, they quarrelled about their studies.
"You think you can understand history just by studying people? What about the will of the spirits to protect their elements and domains?" Dagana challenged him as she dressed for the day while he still lounged in her warm and rumpled blankets.
"What spirits? I don't see any spirits. I see people pursuing human aims."
"Don't be deliberately dense, Thalen."
"You can call the wind Ghibli or call the ocean Lotan if you like the names, but what's the point?"
"What's the point of calling you Thalen as opposed to man?" countered Dagana.
"Thalen refers to one individual. But the wind I feel today is not the same wind that blew yesterday, or that blows in Sutterdam, or across the sea."
"All air, all over the world, moves by the will of Ghibli, just as the sunshine comes from Sole," she reproved him. "And Ghibli will blow down any structure that displeases it, just as Lotan will wreck any ship that trespasses without permission. Tutor Hilbus says that the spirits choose human agents to speak for them in human affairs. We have sacred texts such as the story of Adachron, once a simple carver, later eyewitness to works of wonder as the agent of Chaemon's spirit of the stone."
"Any madman can claim to be connected to the spirits," grumbled Thalen, "and any gullible fool looking for solace from a world of hurts can follow madmen."
"Every indication points to Adachron being sane and rational, more sane and rational than a potter's son who makes judgments about things he knows nothing about. Adachron's book and other texts explain magic and how each spirit favors its chosen people. You're slandering my whole field of study just to be provoking."
"I don't like the idea of bowing and scraping to unseen elements," said Thalen. "Free staters no longer tolerate a monarchy, even if Rorthers do. And you always ignore the influence of time and social circumstances. Besides, even according to your system, some countries don't have hovering, loving spirits. That's just plain unfair. Why should one people be chosen and another abandoned? That's just as unfair as one country having rich soil and another having poor."
"Not all of the spirits demand or even appreciate human reverence," Dagana replied, overlooking his point about equity. "Nargis merely wants people to keep its sweet water pure. Sole asks for nothing at all. Lotan expects libations. Only Posar expects that sacrifices be thrown into volcanoes."
"I hope they choose religious fools as sacrifice." In anger, Dagana threw her hairbrush at him and slammed the door on her way out. Since she landed her blow, Thalen earned himself a bit of a bruise. He felt ill-used. A few minutes later, when he tossed his cloak over his shoulders, he accidentally knocked over Dagana's bottle of scent. The aroma, the smell of her neck, elbow and bosom induced a rush of desire. But telling himself he had to hurry to the refectory for fast break before it stopped serving, Thalen neither made up the bed nor straightened the things he'd disarranged. After eating, he felt ashamed of his petty behaviour, so he stopped back by Dagana's room to place the scent bottle upright, mop up the spill, pick up her scattered hairpins, and refill her vase with an offering of lilies of the valley.
That afternoon, he met with Tutor Granelton in his book-strewn second-floor office. These meetings had grown longer and more intense as Thalen finished preliminary readings. He had to use all his wits to keep up with his tutor's expectations.
"No country has stepped forward to punish Oromondo for its invasion of Alpeta," said his tutor. "Why is that?"
"Wirrendale is without a queen. Lortharod would be capable, but her current king does not believe it in his country's interests to engage in foreign battles. This now leaves Melodrin unsupported and unprotected."
"What could be done to forestall an invasion of Melodrin?"
Granelton tapped his folded spectacles against his desk.
"If Oromondo threatens its neighbors out of scarcity, countries could sell Oromondo the food it needs."
"And why are they not offering such wares, young man?"
"Not enough transportation?" Thalen guessed. Granelton looked sour.
"Did you learn naught from Wars of the Magi?"
"Ah, yes." Grateful for the hint, Thalen leaned back in his chair.
"Even before the War of the Priests, Oromondo threatened the peace. For centuries, its magi have believed it their right, their duty, really, to convert the peoples of the world to their faith. They will do this by persuasion or by force. They believe that Pozar granted them passion."
"What do they mean by passion?"
"They define it primarily in a religious sense, a passionate faith, but also in terms of love or other strong emotions."
"So the food scarcity may be genuine now, but it ties into a longer history of religious expansion," said Granelton. "Religious expansionism will never win a country allies. Moreover, states hold long grudges. No realm would step forward to help the Oromondians. They would sooner let them starve. Short-sighted, really. When you drive a country into desperate straits, you shouldn't be surprised how it reacts."
"Tudor, I have been thinking about the food scarcity and the blights that affect Oromondo. The reports of illness, dying animals, and ruined crops are so varied and so widespread."
"So?"
Granelton was gazing down at some papers, only half listening.
"I don't know of anything quite like this. Usually a crop disease affects only crops, an animal disease affects only animals, and only certain animals at that, not all of them."
"True. This is why the Oros charge the Weirs with deliberate sabotage."
Thalen stood up and began to pace, conscious that the theory he had been forming would sound preposterous.
"But crops, animals, people, there is one thing they all share in common. You know, I studied earth and water first. I've been thinking about something the Tutor Irenaeus said, something about the clarity of a lake also being a matter of life and death. What if all the water in Oromondo is tainted?"
Well, maybe not all," Thalen rushed to qualify. "Maybe half, maybe most.
You could see where the water was worst by tracing the progress of the blights over the years. That is, if we have maps and good records."
"Tainted? But how?"
Thalen now had Granelton's full attention.
"What could taint half the waters of an enormous country? Surely not poison. Magic?"
"I don't know," said Thalen, wincing. "Still ponds grow scum that sours the water, but that couldn't be true of all of Oromondo, with the rivers that rush down from the high snowy mountains."
"This is an interesting theory,"
Granelton paused, considering.
"As soon as you have a chance, go back to Irenaeus, who knows about such things, and talk to her about it."
Inwardly, Thalen quailed, because having left Tutor Irinia's tutelage, he felt it to be rude and awkward to go back to her and beg her for help.
"Sit down, young man, and let's continue reviewing your reading. What, historically, has kept the Magi from achieving their goals?"
Thalen knew this answer. Somehow, the Weir Queens have always possessed an appropriate talent that forced at least a stalemate.
"Yes," said Granolton. "A wide array of talents, each uniquely suited to the threat at hand."
Thalen interrupted the thread of their discussion. "Tudor, in History of the Weirs, there's an oblique reference to the initial crime, but no explanation."
"Ah, yes, the Weirs have a bad conscience about that, and they have tried to scrub references from the literature. Here's the version I know. About 400 years ago, a ship from Oromondo landed in Queen's Harbour in Weirendale, full of refugees who sought asylum from a despotic regime. The immigrants pledged to be faithful to their adopted realm as long as the Weirs permitted them religious freedom. The queen of the time, I think it was Cinda the Conqueror, initially welcomed the fugitives and granted them sanctuary. But some years later, she heard complaints that the Oros were sacrificing animals as part of their rituals. This upset her, so she had the Oro asylum seekers rounded up and slaughtered. Babes, children, women, everyone. That is the initial crime."
"Harsh," said Thalen, wrinkling his nose. "If you promise religious liberty, you may have to tolerate practices you dislike, or at least not kill people for them, give them a chance to emigrate elsewhere or adapt their practices."
"Indeed," agreed his tutor. "The Weirs tried to excuse their massacre by claiming that the Oros threw the offal in the river, and no one knows the true facts anymore. And Cinda issued a strange proclamation about her grandmother's close connection with animals. Many years later, one of the queens, I don't recall a blasted name, but a sobriquet was The Just, officially apologised for this barbarity, but the seeds of enduring enmity had been sown."
"And since then, Oromondo has sought vengeance, but been held in check by each queen's talent?" asked Thalen.
"Right," said Granolton. "So, returning to the present day, we might partially ascribe this current invasion of Alpitar to the death of Queen Cressa and the mysterious absence of her heir. Now then, for tomorrow. 1. Read this new work, The Limitations of Diplomacy by Tenney."
He handed Thalen a manuscript. Granolton held up another finger.
"And 2. Attend the concert of Lays tonight, put on by the music students."
"Sir, I was planning to go because one of my friends studies music, but I would think that lays present distortions of history. These songs offer history with all the complications and ugly bits left out."
"Young man, that's where you're wrong. Lays fascinate historians because they reduce everything to the actions of key individuals, neglecting larger forces such as drought or epidemics or," he inclined his head towards his pupil, "poisoned water. You should have already read my humble contribution, The Songs of Rotherod, Examined. Moreover, by studying lays, we can understand how countries desire to understand their pasts, and yet interspersed with all the fiction, because songwriters compose them close to the time of events, lays often give historians specific details. We use them as primary source material, especially about magic."
Thalen leaned forward in his chair.
"Sir, I don't know what to think about magic. Could we discuss the lay of Queen Cressa? The Weir composers talked with seamen on the ships that trail behind. Certain stanzas have been running through my mind. The lines about a rain of boulders of fire. I cannot think of any natural phenomenon on the seacoast so distant from the volcanoes that would... A knock on the door interrupted their lesson, and a servant entered with a letter for Granelton. Thalen felt awkwardly in the way, so he pretended to scan his notes while his tutor tore it open.
That is all for today. In fact, you will have to work on your own this week, young man. Finally, they have paid attention to my entreaties. I have been summoned to an audience with the Assembly of Electors. I hope to persuade the electors to mass our armies at the Causeway of Stones to block the Oros from even entering the Free States. While I am away, I want you to write an essay on why Rotherod has fallen from its former status as a great power.
Granelton waggled three fingers in the air.
I'll expect you to cite the lays from the concert, my modest contribution, and Mariah's The Fall of Rotherod. Mariah of Feldspar has no great analytical powers, but she was an eyewitness to the later events.